Okay, thanks, Ron. Thank you so much for the food and the prayer and the fellowship and all that goes with it. It's great. And we look forward to it each and every week in the middle of the week. And, it gives us a time of refreshing and a time that we can slow down and open the Word of God and look at it for a little while and reflect upon it and to realize and understand what we have. And, you know, we've been in Psalms now for the past few weeks. And I'm kind of blown away by the fact that, you know, Psalms is generally, you know, a thing of supplications or a song of praise or a prayer of praising God. And I was just thinking about it as I was going over it this week that, you know, that these men quite often prayed prayers that God felt so moved with that they were preserved in Holy Writ that we could read them, study them, and understand them even hundreds or thousands of years later. And that is something that, you know, when you stop to think about it a little bit, it would be such a great honor to be able to have a prayer on your mind and on your heart and lips that God would preserve and keep for the ages to come. And it just blows me away and when I think about it. But yet, here they are. And they're preserved for us that we can look at them and read them and study them. And, you know, a lot of times people, and I know I've done the same thing, would just go through and read Psalms and never really stop to say, well, what did that mean? Or what does this mean? But when you get to looking at it and you begin to do some searching into it and studying into it, and you can see that God had given much more wisdom and knowledge than we sometimes give the people credit for that were doing and saying these things. And especially David. David, he certainly knew a lot that I think mankind didn't know. And especially to that was yet to come. And you know, and a lot of the things he said fits right in with what Paul said, you know, after he understood mystery truth. And you know, when you look back upon it, you can fit it in and say, oh yeah, you know, he had an inkling, but whether or not he really understood all this or not, I can't say. But gee, it was it just gets me to go back and read these things and be able to add now what we know is further truth to it and say, yeah, I know, I now can understand what you're talking about. Turn with me to Psalms 101. 101. It's on page 818, and if you have a companion Bible, it's on page 818, and it says a Psalm of David. And these Psalms from 101 to 105 gives you an idea of rest for the earth at that time, and of course the earth celebrating this rest in the promise of the one that was to come that would enable that to take place. And Psalms 101 deals with the coming king and the king's rule. And so, you know, the Messiah was promised, and he was, they understood him to come as a king, but he came as a man and a servant, you know, and people couldn't accept that. Maybe, I don't know, but at least they didn't at the time, but it served the purpose and the will of God that his son would come and bear that burden for the rest of us, that we might have hope in that sense, that way. And so this is one that has the word walk in it. And then I want to look at this one, and if we got time, I want to look at Psalms 115 also. And tonight, because I think both of them are very important, and it's and this is in relationship to the true David or to the Messiah when he comes, and in this coming rule, he's coming to give rest to the earth, and certainly the vow is and was that when he comes, he's going to come to rule in righteousness. And this is study 32 in our study that's been going on for a little while, and for the tape, it is the study 32 in the study, in the word study walk, and today's date is April the 22nd, 2015. So let's just go ahead and get involved in it and get started and see how far we can go in these two psalms this afternoon or tonight. And it says, the song of David, I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. So in the very first verse, he's talking about he's going to sing of mercy and judgment. And mercy covers verses 1 and 2. And judgment deals with verses 3, 4, and 5. Now, there's only 8 verses in this psalm, but I wanted to bring that to our attention. Then he said, I will sing of mercy. And I think this is a song here that was preserved. And mercy there is loving kindness and or grace or both. And God's mercy deals with his love toward mankind, and certainly his grace that he sheds upon them. And mercy is 78:91, and it's the word singular because there's a it's going to be used again in another way, but here it is 78:91, and it means in the English, it is sheer or shore. And then we'll get to the other part of it. In just a minute. So it says, I will sing sheer shore mercy of mercy and judgment. And again, mercy is loving kindness and or grace or both. And then he says, and judgment. So he combines the two together. And judgment here is reserved for verses 3, 4, and 5. But the singing up there in verse 1, or where he says, I will sing, gives you the idea, the shearer or the shower, gives you the idea of a strolling minister, a minstrel, you know, somebody that walks around, plays an instrument, makes music, and sings a song with a story. And so, this is what, the singing there refers to sing, like a strolling minstrel. And it says, unto thee, or unto you, O Lord Jehovah, will I sing. So, there, O Lord, is Jehovah. And then when you look at that, will I sing, there is a different, it's a different number. It's not like the first one where it's 7891. It's 2167 in the Strong's. And the word is Zomar. And so the difference in the two, one is like a strolling minstrel. But here's how it goes. Zomar means to strike with the fingers, especially strings for music. So if you're a strolling minstrel, you're going to be playing some type of instrument with a story that he felt like that God would hear. And so we know that David was certainly a musical man, and he could, not only could he build instruments of music, but he could play instruments of music along with being a man of war and being king and being a lot of other things. He was a multi-talented individual, someone that God chose when he was doing menial work in the field, keeping the sheep and keeping them safe. So he said, I will sing, 2167, Zomar, to strike with the fingers, strings for music. And so, you know, that goes right along with the minstrel there. So the two types of singing there has different meanings in that sense. But put them together, you get gives you a mind picture of what he's talking about here. Verse 2, I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. Oh, when wilt thou come unto me? There's a question there. Oh, when will thou come unto me? And then the third part of that verse, it says, I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. And these things, you know, don't quite seem to be related until you get to looking at them. And he says in verse 2, I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. What he's saying here, I will give mine. I will give my mind. This behaving is having control of yourself. And you know, your mind controls your body. So it, he says, you know, I will give mine. I will mind myself wisely in action. So he says, I will give mind in actions in a perfect or blameless way or walk. When you look at that way, you know, anytime you talk about a way, that generally means a movement of some sort, a walk. And so he says, I'm going to give my mind to myself wisely in the actions that I do in a blameless way or blameless walk. And that makes sense. And then he asks the questions, oh, when will, or at what time, wilt thou come unto me? And he said, at what time as king shall thou come? So he's looking for this king that had been promised to the nation of Israel, the king that they said they wanted concerning Saul. And God, you remember, told Samuel, said, go ahead, give him Saul, but you tell him what Saul was going to do for you. You remember that? So he says, oh, when will, or at what time thou come unto me as king shall you come? He's looking for, David was looking for that king to come. He knew he wasn't it, but he knew there was one that was out there that was going to. And then the third part of this verse, I kind of chuckled under my breath when I read this part of verse 2. Look at it. It says, I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. You know, quite often we think that when we get in our home that, you know, we're secluded, that nobody's watching. But where do we hide from God? How do we hide from God? We can't. So let's break this down a little bit. See what he's saying here. He said, I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. As man, I will walk. 1980, Pollack. Means I can go where I want to in my house. And another way of putting that is my life in private. As man, I will walk, or I will control my life in private with a perfect heart, as blameless. You see, if you go into your house, you can't hide from God. So, you might hide from the rest of the world, and you might do things in your own house that you think nobody won't see or know about, but yet God knows. And so therefore he says, when I'm walking within my house, I'm going to do it with a perfect heart. I am going to be blameless. Now who can, you know. So a lot of times we think, well, you know, we're do what we want to in our own place. Well, you can, yeah. But you're not hidden, even though you got walls around you. We're not hidden. So think about that a little bit and see if you might agree. I will walk, or as man walks. As man walks. My life in private or within mine house. That seems to be real cozy and comfy. Do what I want to. With a perfect heart. To be blameless. So that's verses 1 and 2. And it deals with mercy there. Loving kindness and grace. Let's look at 3, 4, and 5, because this is where the word judgment comes in that you see there in verse 1. He said, I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. This is verse 3. I hate the works of them that turn aside, and it shall not cleave unto me. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. I will establish no thing of Belial or no idol, nothing of idolatry. Before mine eyes or to look upon. Because that's what we use our eyes for, is to look upon, make discernments. So he says, I will establish no thing wicked, no idol or nothing of Belial before mine eyes to look upon. I hate the work of them that turn aside. And he says, I have always hated the doings or the business of them that do idolatry. And it says, it shall not cleave unto me. No wish or will on David's part to have any part of anything concerning idols, the work of Belial, or anything of that sort, be it far from him. And so that is a judgment made by one that loathed those things that God loathed. 4. A froward heart, not a forward heart, but a froward heart. Different. The R and the O in the English.
Kind of old English.
Turns around, turns this thing around, see. A froward heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. Froward means perverse or that from what is right. And he says, that kind of a heart shall depart from me or will not be allowed within me. He didn't want to have anything to do with a froward heart. And of course, he's like we are. And it kind of goes back to the old man, new man situation, you know. When you think ahead and you think of what's said in Paul's writing concerning the old and the new, you can kind of see some of what he's saying here, because he has an understanding there of a nature, the nature of man and the bad side along with the good side. And he says, I don't want no part of the bad side. See, and he says, I will not know a wicked person. And in this part, he says, I will have no dealings with those that are lawless. And that's what, as how he looked at a wicked person, is someone that didn't keep the law or didn't do what God had asked him to do. He didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, we say we got to go out and convert the sinner. Well, the former king of Israel didn't look at it that way. He didn't want to know anybody like that. He wanted to deal with the people that were upright, the God-fearing people, the ones who feared God and worshiped Him. Okay. Verse 5. Whoso privately, privily slandereth his neighbor, him will I cut off. Him that hath a high look and a proud heart will not I suffer.
No high-mindedness.
Yeah. So, verse 5 here is whoso, and that means anyone. Whoso, anyone, or whosoever. You know, we add the ever on it a lot of times. Whosoever or anyone. Privately slandereth, and that's privately slandereth there is 3960. And the English for that is lothsam. And it means to privately wag the tongue. To privately wag the tongue. To say things that need not be said. Okay? Who privily slandereth his neighbor or accuse with that wagging of the tongue his neighbor. He said, him will I cut off. And cut off there means to destroy. Now, David was a man of war. And we know what it means when you go to war and you destroy something. That means you kill it off. It's gone. Okay. So he says, anyone that privately wags the tongue and accuses neighbor, I'm going to I'll destroy him.
Wow.
Him that hath a high look. The high look is 5869 in the Strong's, and it's ayin. And it means an eye of affliction or conceit. You know, if you look at somebody like you're going to do them in, you know, you can give somebody that look. He's out to get me. I mean, you know, we've all seen that look from different ones from time to time that you're not going to go to a picnic with them. So he that hath a high look and a proud heart will not I suffer. So we see that look there is the eye of affliction or conceit, and a proud heart, a large and blatant or broad heart there stands for man or a person or a being. Have a large, blatant, or broad being, meaning that he makes himself larger than he really is. And he says, will not I suffer. And that's 3201 in the Hebrew, and it means yoko. And that is, I will not be able to endure that. He's not going to put up with it. He's not going to stand it. It's just not going to be. This, again, it kind of goes back to the thing of being cut off, if you will, in that sense. So those three verses give you verses of judgment that the man says, you know, if these things take place, this is what I'm going to do about them. And and they're in Holy Writ. So let's look at verses 6, 7, and 8. Let's look at the last three there. And it says, "Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the Lamb, that they may dwell with me. He that walketh in a perfect way, he shall serve me." So it kind of goes to a point to where I think he's talking about the one that's going to come. And again, the perfect way, as he talked about, he said he's going to behave himself in a perfect way. And I think when the one that comes is promised, when he comes, it's going to be a perfect way. So, you know, in that sense, it makes sense. "Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land." And what he's saying here, I look at my love, and my love is what God gave to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and those that followed him concerning Israel. And so that was the love. That's the faithful of the land. They were going to occupy the land and going to be as sands of the sea and stars of the heavens. And it's the Israel of Palestine. Those Israelites that are truly look for the one that was promised. That they knew there was a promise there, that vow that had been made that they hadn't received yet. And he says for the rest of that verse there in 6, that they may dwell with me, that all of Israel may abide in my presence. So don't you think that when God raises Israel up as a nation again and puts them in that land over there, that Messiah, when he comes back, and he puts them in the land over there, that David's going to be one of the ones that comes back. And so, you know, David's going to see all of them that there in that raising up there. So, when you think about it, you know, it makes great sense. And here is he that walketh. And again, that's 1980, Hallack. "In a perfect way, he shall serve me." So, when we look at that, he that walketh, or chosen to walk, or chosen to go, in a blameless manner, or a blameless manner, says he shall serve me or follow my orders or wishes. We know that when God comes back and he sets his throne up on the earth, he is certainly going to be in control. He is going to be the king that Israel was looking for. And his orders or his wishes is going to be the law of the land, or probably the law of the world at that time. And so so it says, he that walketh. So, you know, there seems to be a choosing in that situation. You know, to go in a perfect way or to go blameless. And it says, he shall serve me. So I think God certainly is going to choose those blameless to serve him. And I know there's going to be after the 1,000 years, there's going to be some that will turn away from him, but nevertheless, you know, he knows the heart of man, and certainly does know the heart of man, so, you know, he knows who's going to serve him, for sure. Verse 7, he that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. So he that worketh deceit, that is 74:23 in the Strong, and it means to betray or to do treachery or to have guile or cause to fall. That is working deceit. Shall not dwell within my house, or will not find residence. He that telleth lies, or he that speaketh untruth, shall not tarry. And that's 35:59. And that's coon, like not C-O-O-N, but K-O-O-N. Coon. And that means to be established or to stand. So he says, in my sight or before me. So when you put it together, he that telleth lies or speaks untruth shall not tarry or be established or be able to stand in my stead or before me, which makes sense. Because we're talking about rest and righteousness here. We're not talking about war and how he handled it, I don't know. But this is what's being put forth. I will early destroy all the wicked of the land, that I may cut off all wicked doers from the city of the Lord. So, you know, this is David talking, but it's showing you a picture of the king that was to come.
Yeah.
I will early destroy morning by morning. And we've got a note there that we need to read in the Companion Bible. On 8, where it says early or morning by morning, i.e. the judgments of a day dealt with within the day. There will be no prisons needed, and the land is going to be kept clean. So you see, in the presence of that king, there's not going to be any prisons needed. The land is going to be kept clean. There's not going to be any jailers in this situation here. So, he says, all of the wicked are the workers of iniquity. The workers of iniquity in the land or Israel. So, evidently, there's going to be judgments made morning by morning, and it's not going to last. It means early. He's going to take care of those things early. The rest of the day is not going to be a bummer.
Yeah. He said, not going to be on death row there for 40 years.
No. He said that I may cut off all the wicked doers from the city of the Lord. And that cut off again. There is the same one that we read up there, I think in verse 5 a while ago, where he talks about destroying them. He said that I might destroy all the wicked doers from the city of the Lord. They're from Zion. And of course, when God comes back and establishes the throne of David, in the city of Zion after the great earthquake, it's going to be in the southwestern part of of the city. You know, that corner of those gates there are going to be left to establish, I think, for the children of Israel that are going to be raised up again and given their blood and breath back, that they'll be able to see something that they can relate to. Because, you know, Israel was asked to go to the city over and over again for these feasts, all of these goings on that God required them to do at different times and different ways. And so that southwestern part of that thing, the earthquake's not going to bother that when you look at I believe Zephaniah, where he talks about the things that are going to take place there. That part of the city is going to be left intact. And out beyond that, I think, is where the throne of God's going to be. And it wouldn't surprise me a bit if that throne of David is not going to be set up on Golgotha, or where Golgotha would that time. Because it would be very fitting in my mind to think that when Christ comes back to rule, that he's going to rule from where they killed him from. Now, that's some of my own thoughts. I'll just throw them in there as a freebie. But it would seem to be fitting and proper, and to me it would make a lot of sense that would take place. Because when he comes back and them feet hit the Mount of Olives again, that earthquake going to take place. And then there's going to be a great shift in the earth there at that time. And when Christ comes back, he is going to have all of the land that God promised in Genesis, from the rivers to the sea and all that. They've never had all that. They've never possessed all that together. Guess what? He will. I think he will. Might be wrong, but I think he will. Turn with me to Psalms 115. Just a few pages over. It's on page 834. And Psalms 115 is entitled in the Companion Bible, Israel's Deliverance from Egypt's Idolatry. And you know, all down through the time that the children of Israel left Egypt, this idolatry thing, these idol worships was greatly within the heart of a lot of the Israelite people. And they would rather go and serve something that wasn't alive rather than serve the true God. It was alive because to them, it was something that they just didn't want to do. So let's get involved in it for a little bit. He said, "Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake." So he said, "Not unto us, not unto us, O Lord Jehovah, not unto us." This glory doesn't belong to us. It belongs to you. "But to thy name," or the name of Jehovah, "give the glory," or "give glory." And I think it's "the glory." And it says, "for thy mercy." And again, it goes back to the psalm that we just read where it talks about the mercy being loving kindness or grace that is always shown by God toward mankind, because man here is the one that God's concerned about, is man. When he created Adam, you know, and all the things he created something from the dust of judgment. And he gave him that wonderful life breath. And he gave him all these things that we have that we really don't deserve. You know, we look at our animals and we look around and say, well, they've got these things by instincts. You know, but we have a mind that can think and can come to understand what God has really done for us in that sense. But he said, not unto us the glory should be to you, Jehovah. Verse 2, wherefore should the heathen say, where is now their God? So we get right down to the nitty gritty right quick. Wherefore or why? Why would man or the heathen, wherefore should the heathen say? Why, what, how, and when is some of the questions that he asked. Should the heathen say, or the nations ask? They're going to ask, well, where's my God? You know, it seems like that God chose a nation, Israel. And this is heathen theology here. Say, well, where's my God? If I don't have a God, I'll make me one. Right? You know, that's kind of the way to think. You know, we go to Ephesians 2:11 and 12, and we read Ephesians 2:11 and 12, and it talks about the Gentile being without God and not having God in the world. It's on page 1763. Let's just turn over there for just a minute. Ephesians 2:11. And 12. And Paul says this, wherefore remember that we being in times past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called the circumcision, in the flesh made by hands, that at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, okay, and strangers from the covenants of promise, okay, having no hope, woe, and without God in the world. So, yeah, the heathen could say at that time, we're backing up now some hundreds or thousands of years. And man, the heathen, would say if he wasn't associated with Israel in a way where he could come to understand God and what God had for the nation of Israel and for they hope, and you could be proselyted in, but if that didn't suit you, the only other thing they had was said, well, we'll make us a God. And so they would use that as a way to reconcile themselves in that situation. Well, let's look at it. Let's look at some of this heathen theology. And there's a little list here. In verse 3 it says, "But our God is in the heavens, and he hath done whatsoever he hath pleased." So, that's the difference between the two. Man could say, "Well, I don't have a God, so I'm going to establish me one." But Israel would say, "Well, our God is in the heavens, and he hath done whatsoever he pleased." But Jehovah is in or abides in the heavens, or the upon heavenlies. That's Israel's oath. "He hath done whatsoever he pleased." God. He or they. You know, when we go back to Genesis, it says, "Let us." And here we have, I think, the three is one, and the one is three. "Hath done or created whatsoever he hath pleased." Whatever it was for his purpose that he wanted, he could create. He could speak into being. Man can't do that.
Amen.
Everything we do, you know, is we can fabricate stuff up from what already exists. But God has a way of changing those things. You know, when he laid Adam out, and he took this dust of judgment, and he formed it into these bodies that we have that are so intricate, but we're still trying to figure them out all these years later. 6,000 years later, we're still trying to figure out these bodies. But you know, when Christ was here and the man was blind and couldn't see, he took a little of his spit, put it into the dust of the earth, and rubbed it in the man's eyes.
Which would normally be pretty painful.
He could see.
Yeah, fixed him.
He made him some eyes right there. Gee, okay, let's go on. So we understand that God created for his purpose. That's what's really is what's being said here. That God can create for his purpose anything that he needs or wants. Let's look at 4 through 8, because here again is the heathen theology. "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands." Okay. "The heathen gods are made from silver and gold, and they contain no life. Not before, not during, or not after." Silver and gold is what we call precious metals, but it doesn't have life. It doesn't take life on of itself. "And these are fabrications or the work of men's hands." Men's hands, God has allowed man the understanding to use his limbs to make things that he needs. And that within itself is a great resource that sometimes we don't really grasp. But it can be for the wrong thing. And this is, we're talking here about the wrong things now. Verse 5. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes they have, but they see not. So they, means the idols, have mouths, but they are mute. No sound comes from that mouth. Eyes have they, the word says, but they see not. They're blind. There's nothing there to see with. And verse 6 says, they have ears, but they hear not. They're deaf. Noses they have, but they smell not. Well, this is one of the senses that man has, you know, that is given as an attribute of God also, that when God required a sacrifice and it was burnt with fire, it became a sweet-smelling savor. And it smelled good to God. That when it was done in accordance to His plan and purpose, it was a sweet-smelling savor. But these idols don't have that ability. They can't breathe air, so therefore they can't smell. The odor doesn't carry. Verse 7, it says, they have hands, but they handle not. They cannot feel a touch. Feet they have, but they walk not. So an idol is unable to move. You know, when I was over in Japan for a month a few years ago, they would have these little shrines, and each house just about would have one in their house or their home. And they would have the idol there, probably a Buddha or whatever. And, you know, it was always there. It didn't go anywhere. It couldn't do anything. It was unable to move. And it says, neither speak they through their throat, because there's no passage in the throat. But yet man had formed it to look like a man, or to look like someone. And so it had all these attributes, but none of them worked. Nothing worked. Well, look at verse 8. They that make them are likened unto them. So is everyone that trusteth in them. So they said, men who fabricate these things are alike or the same as the idol. And so is everyone or all that trusteth or put faith in dead idols. They're dead men. Just like the dead idols.
Never understood the whole worship of the idol that can't do it. And obviously, if you have to carry it and put it somewhere to worship it, it can't do much.
It can't go nowhere, can't do anything. It doesn't hear you.
Yeah.
You know, a prayer to an idol is like blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
You know.
And very that's good song.
And so we're out of time. And we'll go ahead and finish this up next time. But I've already blown my time. So we'll pick up with verse 10 or 9 in our next study. We'll pick up with verse 9 and go through the rest of this, because it is so telling as to how senseless this idea is. But, you know, it seems like that somewhere in man there is a need of worship. And this idol worship fills that need. And I think that's part of Satan's ploy to fulfill the old man's desire that to where he can reconcile himself rather than to be reconciled before God. That he can reconcile himself in that fashion. Because it seems like it's just blowing in the wind. It's just senseless. Is the way it goes. So we'll close. We'll stop with that. I wanted to get it in, but I kind of felt like it might be a little more than I had time to do. Certainly it has. I've got another whole sheet of notes here. And all of it gives you the understanding of how silly it is. But yet man goes back to his own devices and his own silliness. And he tries again to reconcile himself rather than to be reconciled before God with these things. And so when I was in Japan, that was one thing that I saw that they do it in a big way, you know, and they got all these temples and all these things built with these shrines made out of gold and all this stuff. And it kind of emulates what God told Solomon to do with the temple, you know, and they've got a Buddha, golden Buddha in this golden shrine over there by this lake or pond that they have and all this stuff. And it makes you wonder that, you know, what are they trying to do here? Are they trying to make fun of God?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it kind of worked out that way. It did with me.
Brandon had a good note here. He said, if man has to make the idol, then he is aware that the idol did not make him.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Sure.
Good note, Brandon.
So that's just the way it is. So thank you for your time, and we'll finish this one out, and I've got at least two or three more that I want to do before we get out of Psalm. But, you know, some of these things are just, they're just so great you can't pass them up. Just can't do it.
This one is really telling.
So thank you for your time, and hopefully that we covered something that might be of some use to you. But you know, when you look at it and you read it, in light with what you know now and what you've been chosen for now. You get these little minutes or places where you can look at it and say, you know, that it enlightens you to some of the things that they knew but weren't able to put it together yet because these things hadn't been revealed by God in its clear sense. But yet, you know, God has his way of bringing it all together. And that's the great thing about the Word of God. There's answers to anything you're looking for. It's just getting it, bringing it together. And that's our job. That's what we're supposed to do is studiers and teachers are just, you know, somebody that need not to be ashamed to be a workman that can look, can discern and see and use these things that God has given us. They're not instincts. They're senses that we can sense our maker with and know that he made us and that we're made for a purpose and for a plan and that we ought to get on with the program and get on with that plan.
Amen.
So thank you much. being with us today.